This is a CBC podcast.
Obama's MySpace mistake, the Great Poca Rebellion, and John F. Brewington, internet detective. Those are your keywords. I'm Jesse Brown, and this is Search Engine. Are you anxious about internet identity theft? Are you feeling squirrely about online security? Are you in a panic over web privacy? Me neither. In fact, despite a decade of high-pitched scare stories from the media, a recent study out of California shows that most people wouldn't pay so much as a quarter to protect their personal data from marketers. And by personal data, I mean personal, like, say, your body weight or how many sex partners you've had. People just don't seem to really care. Like a couple of years ago, when word got around that by signing up for Google's Gmail service, millions of people had given Google small print permission to read their private emails for advertising purposes. Remember what happened then? Millions more people signed up for Gmail. That's what happened. Even right now, Facebook's gearing up to do the same, dipping into the data of its 40 million users who carefully chronicle their every friendship and flirtation. Facebook's plan is to rent out sliced and diced chunks of this audience to hungry advertisers. Last week, I got a notice on my Facebook page asking me to click a box if I didn't want them to start sharing basic details about me with the big search engines. I was appalled. I gasped, really. And then I did nothing. It's not that I'm lazy. It's that for me, and millions like me, the fear of being out of the loop is greater than the fear of being exposed. It's just not clear what it costs me to be so public. Much has been written lately disapproving of us privacy in different types. But I would suggest that, for me anyway, it's not so much that I'm dying to be exposed. It's that I know that there's no point in being bashful. I know that I'm being Googled because I Google everyone I meet. And frankly, I'd rather control the results. Now, perhaps this lax attitude about online privacy is foolish. In a moment, you'll hear a story about how what's said on the internet can do real damage to people's lives and livelihoods. But for now, let me suggest a thought. 10 years from today, when everyone's accumulated a few hundred embarrassing things about themselves on the internet, well, won't that be the same as no one having any? At that point, it'll be the people with nothing scandalous online who'll seem truly suspicious. Benjamin Franklin once said that a person's reputation is like glass, easily cracked and hard to mend. And Franklin said that years before the internet. These days, a few casual words of slander, written anonymously, can follow you around for years. And if your business relies on your good name, any careless smear can be costly. So what do you do when your professional reputation lies in shards at your feet? Well, you might make a long-distance call to Arizona and talk to John F. Brewington, internet detective. Search Engine did. Hello, John.
Hi, Jesse.
Can you give me a quick example of a typical client and a typical case you take?
I don't know that there is a typical one. It runs the gamut. A woman, for example, who at one point in time, she's working a regular job, but decided she wanted to be a dog breeder. And, you know, it was a business that she had little expertise in. It came out cataclysmically. She had some customers that were disenfranchised with her services, and they went on the internet and destroyed her. My experience with her was that she was an extremely pleasant person. I could find no public records about her whatsoever. She recognized that she made some mistakes, and so this is someone that I have a great deal of compassion for. I think, you know, let's find some kind of way to fix this problem. There's companies out there that kind of specialize in going into MySpace, Facebook, and build a reputation for you, if you will, that has stronger links than the negative ones that are on the front pages of search engines, effectively pushing those negative links out.
So, John, what did you do for this woman, the dog breeder?
I went to one in particular and asked him if he minded volunteering some of his time and expertise in helping this woman, you know, get this stuff off the internet. I mean, she was applying for a job. And I don't know if you know it, but approximately 33% of all human resources managers will go into Google and do a background search on someone, and they'll make decisions about them based upon the disinformation that's in the internet. So she was concerned. I went to somebody. They're helping her out.
So you act as an intermediary. Do you ever put pressure yourself on someone to remove slander or criticism?
No, I don't. And it's a difficult thing for me. I believe in the freedom of speech, but I also believe in innocent until proven guilty. I believe that a person's past can very well stay in the past, that you have an opportunity to step forward and change your life for the better if that's what you want to do, and it's not up to me to judge, and nor is it up to me to strong-arm someone else to remove some of these items. Now, I have to tell you, as the lightning rod, if you will, against some of these sites, they've attacked me.
Well, I wonder about that, and it is true that when I Googled you, it looks like you've made some enemies, and I don't think we should get into it now. We can put some links up on the blog of this particular case. There seems to be a lot of ins and outs of you and this consumer advocacy site, Ripoff Report, and you've exposed them, and then they come back and slander you. We can get into that on the site. What I'm curious about is, if the top search result when I search for John F. Brewington is a slanderous account or a very critical account that I'm sure you don't want up there, what can you offer your clients if you can't remove your own name from those search results?
Well, I haven't really tried to remove my name on there. That can be an endless source of frustration for you. Plus, I'm a witness in a federal suit against the aforementioned site, and have been providing the FBI with a great deal of information. So, number one, I don't care. I've got a thick hide, and it's a never-ending battle.
John, you've been a traditional investigator for most of your life. According to your website, it seems like you handle infidelity cases, things like that. How is it that you decided to take on internet defamation cases, and just how does one become an internet dick?
Well, I did it quite by accident. You know, first and foremost, I'm a business owner, and as a business owner, I have to deal with the internet every day for my own website and for all of these things. And, you know, I knew absolutely nothing about it. So I started digging in and trying to figure out what was going on. What are these guys doing? How are they able to do it? They can go on the internet and say anything they want. Or they can be a competitor of a business person, and they can go on the internet and try to destroy them. Or they can be an ex-wife, and they can go on the internet and destroy them. I don't like bullies, Jesse. I don't like bullies.
John, thanks for talking with me today.
I enjoyed it, Jesse.
John F. Brewington is an Arizona state-licensed private investigator specializing in internet defamation. To read about his conflict with ripoffreport.com or to learn more about the reputation cleanup industry, visit our blog at cbc.ca/search engine. Last week, on our first show, I announced Mob Docs, our first collaborative journalism project. In case you missed it, a Mob Doc is a radio documentary where anyone in our audience, anywhere in the world, is a potential freelance reporter. We're inviting those of you who are interested to collect audio recordings for us on a specific topic, and then we'll weave together some of those submissions into a finished documentary, which we'll broadcast on the radio. And if we use your recording, we'll pay you, the same as we would any freelancer. Our current Mob Docs assignment asks the question, what does the internet sound like? Last week, I played you an example, a clip I recorded in Jerusalem in an internet cafe in the Old City, where a group of Palestinian kids were playing Grand Theft Auto and Counter-Strike as the call to prayer echoed in the background. This week, Mob Docs returns to Canada. We received this audio upload from Jennifer Moss in Vancouver. Here's what the internet sounds like in her house.
Even if you're supposed to use the mouse or the arrow keys.
You're supposed to use the mouse, right?
Okay, Molly, you know what? Your time's up now. Aiden? You gotta say goodbye to Aiden, okay?
I can't. I have to go to dinner. Oh, that can't feel good. Aiden? Hello? Yeah, you get lots of lives, though. Ah! I just died.
Hey, Molly, about 5 more minutes.
Okay, I'm just talking to my mom. Do you want to do this tomorrow after school and meet me by the... and go to the nightclub? Bye.
Send us your mob doc clip. What we're looking for here are sounds of what the internet sounds like where you are. If this grabs you, check out our website for all the details. You can also hear other people's submissions as they come in. We're at cbc.ca/search engine. Just look for mob docs. If you're just joining us, I'm Jesse Brown, and this is Search Engine, a radio show that predicts the present. Sound Exchange is a music industry association that exists to make sure that when music gets played on the internet, websites have to pay royalties. But what happens when musicians themselves want their music to be played for free? Increasingly, musicians, particularly independent, small label, and niche genre musicians, are turning their backs on big industry associations like Sound Exchange. Leading the pack in this separatist movement is the Polka America Corporation, a nonprofit group dedicated to the promotion of polka music. To discuss their controversial move, Search Engine reached the PAC's vice president, John Ziabrowski, at his office in Rhode Island. Hello, Vice President Ziabrowski. How are you today?
I'm fine. Thank you, sir.
Vice President Ziabrowski, why is the PAC helping polka musicians opt out of licensing that exists to help them?
We were formed to hopefully unite all forms of polka music under a common umbrella. And in doing so, part of our bylaws and our direction is to keep the genre alive, moving forward, acting as one unit. The genre has been in decay now since the 1970s. The crowd is elderly. The average crowd is probably in the 70s now. In order to have polka music prevail, we just feel that there's some other direction the music needs to take to become noticed by the younger generation.
Can you explain to me what's going on with the PAC and the Sound Exchange opt-out?
Basically, the band is saying, here's my CD. You can play it for free on your internet polka program. I do not expect reimbursement from it. That's the basic bottom line of the agreement.
Mr. Ziabrowski, you mentioned before, and it's on the Polka America Corporation's website, that you have this mandate to provide polka and to promote polka and also to unite polka.
Right.
And my question is, I can see how what you're doing helps to provide polka to larger audiences and to promote polka to those audiences. But what I'm wondering is if it, in fact, is uniting the polka community, or is it, in fact, creating discord? How is the polka world taking this?
There's going to be strife no matter what you do and how you do it. There will always be some people objecting to what you do and how you do it. I would say that probably around 97-98% of the people have been very positive and supportive of what we're doing.
It sounds like you're describing the internet as a possible tool in trying to promote polka to a new generation.
It is a tool right now. Internet, as you know, goes everywhere, and the small terrestrial stations that used to handle polka programming and the ones that still do just do not reach a substantial audience any longer.
Mm-hmm.
So the internet seems to be the way to go as far as greater exposure of the genre and all styles of genre. There's an organization out of Cleveland, Ohio called 247 Polka Heaven. They offer polka music 24 hours a day. They offer Polish styles, Slovenian styles, Swiss, German, Czech, Bohemian. They cover the full spectrum of types of polka music. It's organizations like this that are going to prevail in the future as far as maintaining and increasing a level of listenership for polka music in cooperation with us and some of the other polka organizations that are around.
Mr. Ziobrowski, thank you very much for talking with us today.
I thank you. Have a great day.
You too. John Ziobrowski is the vice president of the Polka America Corporation. He spoke to us today from his office in Rhode Island. As Americans gear up for the 2008 presidential election, each candidate is doing what they can to exploit the internet without getting burned by it. The web, after all, is a place where any average Joe can have an impact. We now bring you a story of just such a case. Here is Jeremy Gans with his documentary, I Have More Friends Than Barack Obama.
They don't come much more average than Joe Anthony. According to his MySpace profile, he's 29, single, straight, white, has an average body type, some college education, and a job in LA as a paralegal. In other words, Joe Anthony is an average Joe. But that all changed a few years ago, after he saw a certain senator on TV.
The first time I ever heard Barack Obama speak was back in at his keynote address at the Democratic National Convention.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you.
I guess it's that it factor that, you know, wow, this is the man.
Tonight, we gather to affirm the greatness of our nation.
I thought, he's the one person that could really unite this country.
America, tonight, if you feel the same energy that I do, if you feel the same urgency that I do, if you feel the same passion that I do, if we do what we must do, then I have no doubt that all across the country, the people will rise up, and out of this long political darkness, a brighter day will come. Thank you very much, everybody. God bless you.
The first thing I did, I started that MySpace profile back in November of 2004. It's, a common thing on MySpace to do is to start a fan site. I had a disclaimer on the site at all times. It read that this site is not managed or endorsed by Senator Barack Obama. My goal was only to help spread the word, and share this information. And I think it really helped a lot of people learn about Barack Obama.
Joe soon discovered that he was not the only one excited about the senator from Illinois. People from all over the country were flocking to the page, asking Joe if they could be one of Obama's friends.
When it got to 1,000 friends, I was kind of amazed. And then 2,000 and 3,000. And then at one point, I took maybe a month off from it. And I went back in, and there were 6,000 friend requests.
Joe's fan page just kept growing and growing. At one point, it was getting as many hits as Obama's official campaign page. This caught the attention of Micha Sifri, a former editor at the political magazine The Nation. Sifri had just co-founded TechPresident.com, a website all about political campaigning on the internet.
So he slowly built the site up over 2+ years to the point where this MySpace page had 160,000 friends and instantly put Obama in the lead in the MySpace sweepstakes, if you will. None of the other presidential campaigns had anything close to that.
I was working on the site, in the mornings, throughout the day at work, in the evenings. Like some nights I was up until 2 in the morning, and I would answer everybody's questions, redirect them to the official website. I really got involved, and, I think that in turn got other people more involved.
Joe's page was now attracting mainstream media attention. This was no longer your typical fan page, and Obama's campaign had to figure out what to do about it.
I think that the Obama campaign, instead of deciding, let him keep running this unofficial page for Barack Obama, which they could have done, they said, no, let's let him keep running an unofficial page. We'll collaborate with him, and we'll tell MySpace to start pointing to that page.
The relationship with the campaign started out pretty good. Chris Hughes and I got along, and I shared with him some of my ideas, and I just kind of got the impression that they just wanted to help out and make sure everything was accurate.
There is a conversation about maybe he should come on board, but he didn't want to move to Chicago. He didn't want to tear up his current life and become a campaign professional, and there was no reason to expect that he had to do that. And then the Obama campaign goes, uh-oh, we really need to control this.
How big of an impact can a person have before they become a liability? I don't know at which point they decided that the profile was best handled by them. And I understood why they wanted to control it, because obviously they wanted to control their message. But You know, they offered to pay me a one-time fee to transfer over the profile. And I said, well, okay, well, can you suggest anything? Do you have a ballpark? You know, I've never asked for something like this. I don't know, you know, how to value it. So that night, you know, I stayed up. You know, I went for a walk around my neighborhood probably for about 4 miles. I really put thought into it. What would be fair to me? What would be cost effective to the campaign? And I proposed it.
I asked a bunch of internet veterans from the right to the left how much they thought what Anthony had built was worth. And by and large, everybody thought that $39,000 was a bargain. I mean, there were several people who thought, you know, that you could have easily have valued the site on MySpace at $160,000 at a dollar a name. If just 10% of those people make a political contribution to the campaign, and let's call it an average contribution, say $25, I think that's $400,000.
The pundits all agreed that Joe's offer was more than fair, but Obama's people didn't see it that way.
On April 30th, I spoke with Josh Orton from the campaign, and everything changed. It was, oh, I thought you were doing this because you liked Obama. I didn't know you were in this for commercial purposes. And I said, well, no, that's not what we discussed at all. Chris Hughes asked me to suggest this fee.
What Joe didn't know was that Obama's team had decided that they didn't need to deal with him at all. They had been talking directly with MySpace's head office, figuring out a way to go around him.
Josh said that I could turn the profile over to them or they're going to have it deleted. And I said, well, you know, if you delete 160,000 people, someone's going to miss it. After the conversation, I got an email from Chris Hughes that said, you know, Joe, I heard from Josh that you decided to kill the profile. That was his exact words. You know, I'm sorry all your hard work had to go to waste. Best of luck. An hour later, I was just leaving my office and I got home from work and I was locked out of the profile.
The odd thing in all of this is the Obama campaign never made a counterproposal. And that's where I think they negotiated in bad faith or they were just plain incompetent. The Obama campaign posted an explanation of what went on that really make him out to be almost an extortionist.
You know, I worked on the page for 2.5 years. I rallied support from, you know, tens of thousands of people for this guy. And for them to, you know, I understand why they wanted to take the page. But the way they did it, that was a gigantic slap in the face.
And then Joe got the call.
So he got on the phone and he's, hey, Joe, this is Barack Obama.
Joe had been imagining this conversation for a long time. But he had always pictured it happening under happier circumstances.
At that point, I was just so worn out, I just said, oh, hey, Barack. But yeah, it was a very general conversation, and he thanked me, but he didn't really apologize. I got the impression maybe it was to kind of guilt me into backing down a little bit, because I'm sure they wanted this to go away as quickly as possible, but it is a big deal.
Despite everything, Joe still stands by his candidate. Joe even plans to vote for Obama if he gets the chance, but he doesn't want what happened to be forgotten.
My faith in the system and in partisan politics, it has been crushed a little bit, but you know, I still believe in the power of the individual to have an impact. I mean, obviously I did it and I never expected, you know, this to get this big. I mean, it was surprising every step of the way. So while I still believe in it, you know, I'm not sure if the campaign guys believe that.
That is the true genius of America. That we can say what we think, write what we think without hearing a sudden knock on the door. That we can participate in the political process without fear of retribution, and that our votes will be counted, at least most of the time.
To me, the biggest lesson of this is that the little guy has a megaphone as big as yours. This is the flowering of a new kind of participation in the political process that is very much out of the control of elites. That's what Joe Anthony's experience shows. And in that respect, this is really great for democracy.
Joe Anthony has given up on running fan sites. If you want to find him, he's usually online at his own MySpace page, where, at this moment, he's up to 1,865 friends. For the record, that's 1,797 more friends than average. For Search Engine, I'm Jeremy Gans.
Search Engine emailed the Obama campaign in hopes of getting their side of the story. They never replied, although we have received several email campaign newsletters. It seems we've been added to their bulk mailing list. Search Engine is a collaborative public radio show, which means, among other things, that every story we bring you is first posted to our blog at cbc.ca/searchengine. We invite you to come have a read and maybe share your thoughts. By getting a vigorous discussion going before we go to broadcast, we're able to learn more about our stories up front, and that helps us make better radio. Of course, we also welcome your comments after we've gone to air, and from time to time, we'll read some of your feedback on the show. Here's a comment that was posted to our blog by Wendy Chow in response to our story about the Chinese government's crackdown on dissident bloggers. Ms. Chow writes, "You have come across the big secrets in China. That's very good, because when you publicize these kinds of cases, it relieves some amount of fear from the Chinese people. Most Chinese people will not say anything because they have family in China, and everyone is scared of not following the party line. That is why true journalism is the key to freedom in China. Some people believe the Communist Party, but others are just afraid. These are two problems that the West can help solve." That's a comment on the Search Engine blog, posted by Wendy Chow. In the weeks to come, Search Engine will be continuing on with regular coverage of the situation in China. We hope you'll join us for that. Search Engine is produced by myself, Jeff Siskin, Andrew Parker, and the Search Engine online community. To get involved, visit our site, cbc.ca/searchengine, where you'll also find links and discussion on every story we've talked about, plus our podcast. You can also find us on the Facebook group Search Engine CBC, by email at searchengine@cbc.ca, or by phone at 1-866-399-0927. Special thanks go out today to Ian Balfour. I'm Jesse Brown. Thanks for listening.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.